Hi there, this is Jerry Visco. I'm the host of Visco Disco, The Stupid Show, which is on Radio Free Brooklyn every Friday at midnight. So thank God it's Friday. I hope you're having a great night. And listen to this. Tonight, I have an interview that I did with my ex-boyfriend who's dead. Thank God he's dead. I hate him. His name is C. David Heyman. He was a best-selling author and writer. He's written many books, one of them being Poor Little Rich Girl. And he wrote about the Kennedys and about Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio. And A Woman Named Jackie was a bestseller. Anyway, I lived with him for 6 years, and he was horrible. His name is C. David Heyman. I did this interview with him prior to his demise. His demise was in 2012, and he was 67 years old. And good riddance to him, I can tell you that much. But anyway, the point is, I interviewed him about various things, and he does give some fabulous dirt about the Kennedys, although some of his stuff is bullshit. You know, basically, he was known for... Actually, Newsweek did a cover story about him, about his lying about items. It was published in... In Newsweek. It was a cover story on August 27, 2014, and the article is called C. David Heyman's Lies About JFK and Jackie, Marilyn Monroe, and Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah, he did a book about Elizabeth Taylor. He was a great writer. He also did a book about Ezra Pound, but he lied in all of the books. And as his researcher and girlfriend, I can verify that he did. He would make up quotes by people that didn't exist, and he would do other things that were totally... unethical, and I was going to the School of Journalism at Columbia at the time, so it was kind of upsetting. But anyway, and he was, there were a lot of other bad things. I mean, the guy was smart, and he did do a lot of research, but he decided that he would lie about things because he thought it would get better situation. Anyway, the other things about him is that he was an alcoholic. He was taking medication when I moved in, and because he was an alcoholic, after I moved in, he became impotent. Now, it ain't fun to have a boyfriend that's impotent. You know what I mean? It's like, come on. What the heck? I lived with him 6 years, and we never really had such great relations. But because he was impotent, towards the end of our relationship while I was living with him, he started fooling around with this other woman, which I thought was unacceptable. So I moved out. I think it's because he felt inadequate. And he used to hit me. One time he hit me, and the neighbors called the police, and they arrested him. I should have prosecuted him, but I didn't. I felt sorry for him. But he did go to, he went down to the jail downtown, but I let him get out. Anyway, he did wind up, I moved out after he was sleeping around this other stupid woman, who he wound up marrying. And guess what? Because she didn't know how to cook and she didn't do anything for him, he died like 2 years later. Ha. Good riddance, David Heyman. See, David Heyman. But anyway, the funny thing about it is that she got all the money. She got the money from him and also his mother, who died also. But anyway, Heyman died after collapsing in the lobby of his apartment building. I won't mention his wife's name because, you know, she believed it was cardiopulmonary failure. I'm not so sure about that, although he did have some bad habits, you know. His first book was Ezra Pound, The Last Roar, A Political Profile, published in 1976. It was a good book, but he also lied in that book and said that he had met Ezra Pound, and he never did. He was lying about it. Yes, he was kind of a pathological liar, which was kind of interesting. But sometimes pathological liars are good writers, you know, which is interesting. But anyway, I am going to start this piece, and... you know what? I've had many horrible boyfriends and husbands. I hate men sometimes. I don't hate male friends, but I do. I have very bad taste in men. So anyway, Mr. Heyman was born Clemens Claude Oscar Heyman in Manhattan on January 14th, 1945. So he was a Capricorn and kind of a bitch. He adopted the pen name C. David Heyman at the start of his career. He went to Cornell and got a master's in fine arts from the University of Mass Amherst in 1969, and he had doctoral English literature at the State University of New York. But basically, he was just a very weird guy, you know. But he was a good writer, but unfortunately, he was a liar. I helped do work and research for him on RFK, a candid biography of Robert F. Kennedy, the Georgetown Ladies Social Club, which was in 1998. And I worked with him on the American Legacy, the story of John and Carolyn Kennedy, published in 2007. He pretended that he was the last person to see JFK Jr. before his flight that he got killed, and they wrote about it in the Post, the New York Post, but he lied. He was an utter liar. He didn't see him. And then he also worked on the book about Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio, and I helped work with him on that book, and I did the research, but because of his wife, I didn't get any credit, and the photo that I took in the book is not given credit. So that's really unfair. But anyway, let's listen to C. David Heyman and talk about the Kennedys. And the Kennedys do hate C. David Heyman because he said a lot of negative things about them. And some of them may be true, but a lot of it isn't. So guess what? Fuck you, C. David Heyman. You piece of shit. I'm glad you're dead. I wish you were alive so I could kill you right now. It's a shame. That's the only thing I regret about his dying, is that I could kill him. And I would, because the other bad thing is he made me move out of my rent-stabilized apartment. And when I moved in with him, even though he was rich, he made me pay half of his rent, and I lost my beautiful rent-stabilized apartment. So that is really a bummer. I made a big mistake. He pretended he was going to marry me, but he didn't marry me. So women out there, be careful when a man lies to you. Anyway, let's listen to C. David Heyman talk about the interview that I did for him, which was before he died, so it was back prior to his death in 2012. So I just thought this would be fun because it hasn't been aired and it is new stuff and it's got some real dirt on it. He talks about Jackie Kennedy's, the fact that she didn't change her underwear often. I think that's kind of interesting. And yes, he did know a lot of famous people. He did know, for example, Zsa Zsa Gabor's daughter. And I met her, and he did know many well-known people, and he did have money, even though he was cheap to me. Anyway, this is the interview with David Heyman on Radio Free Brooklyn. Hello. So, David, how are you?
I'm good, Jeremy. Thank you.
And so apparently this book, Bobby and Jackie, has a pub date coming up of July 16th. Is that right?
That's correct, which is unfortunately the 10th anniversary of JFK Jr.'s death. So it, in the one sense, it's sad, but on the other, for me at least, the fact that it's coming out is good. But It's basically a sad day since JFK Jr., I believe, might well have been our president today.
Yeah, you believe so?
I think he had a good chance. He was certainly not what his sister Caroline was when she ran didn't run officially, but put herself up for appointment to become our senator from New York as a replacement for Hillary earlier this year, and was a total embarrassment. I mean, JFK Jr. was very popular, loved people. People loved him. Caroline was an effete snob who just was not used to talking to the public.
Well, you're talking about her in the past tense.
Well, because I think her political career is done, and I think she knew it when she... I think in her mind, I think she actually believed she was taking the place of her brother, because Teddy, who's dying now, Ted Kennedy, wanted obviously somebody in the family to pick up the family legacy. And since John was gone, I mean, he thought his sister, Caroline, his older sister, would take John's place, but that was certainly not to be.
Well, what I found a bit mystifying was it seemed like it was a serious campaign for a little while, and then everything fell apart. What do you think actually happened?
Well, I think Caroline was certainly not really schooled to become a politician. I mean, she herself has described her personality as much too shy and self-effacing, and certainly not a political personality such as JFK Jr. had. I mean, one of the reasons, I think, being that she was 6 years old when her father, JFK, was killed, and she had a very vivid memory of all those events, whereas JFK Jr., as he told me in the previous book that I did, said that he had absolutely no memory of his father whatsoever. I mean, the only memories that he formed were based on what family members told him, on looking at photographs, etc. So I think she was much more affected by the entire event than was her brother. And then in addition, I mean, then Uncle Bobby, Robert F. Kennedy, was killed in 1968, 5 years later, and it had a devastating effect on Caroline. She's, you know, very shy, very much a mother, but not at all a political creature. John, on the other hand, was really, you know, cut in the same figure as his father, JFK, and as Bobby Kennedy, very outgoing, even from young childhood on.
Well, I read your book, American Legacy. What I found amusing was that you compare Caroline to Jackie Kennedy in terms of personality, but in looks she's more of a Kennedy, like either Ted or her father, whereas JFK Jr. looks like a Bouvier because he's very handsome.
Yeah, that's true. But JFK Jr. had the dark coloring of his mother. The Bouviers were like that. And Caroline looks like, it's true, looks like the Kennedys. I mean, she has those buck teeth and the blonde hair and all that, but has the personality of the mother. I mean, much more private, much more sort of almost had an allergy to any public exposure. She, when you see her walking around New York, for example, she's always walking with her head down, whereas JFK Jr. was all over the place all the time. He would ride his bike. He would go rollerblading. You
shirtless.
See him in Central Park. I mean, he loved public attention. He loved people. I mean, I once saw him doing the Irish jig with some homeless guy on the street. He loved, you know, that is the making of a political personality.
On the other hand, I met Carolyn Kennedy at Barnes & Noble at one point, and she was friendly and well-spoken.
You know, I once went to a book signing of hers at Barnes & Noble down on 40th Street, their major main branch. She actually came in, I think this was... I think the book was the Christmas poems, the favorite poems of her mother or something like that. And she actually came in and they announced that Caroline Kennedy would not be reading from the book, but would only be signing books. And she would give no salutation other than signing her name. You could not say to so-and-so, to David, from Caroline Kennedy, only her signature. And I asked one of the security people who worked at the library, who worked at the bookstore, I said, have you ever heard of this before, that an author comes in and actually only is going to sign books? And she said, I've been here for 15 years, and it has never happened before. So even on this kind of an occasion, she couldn't bring herself to, you know, read publicly.
Right. Well, I mean, she does do some public things. I saw her also at one of those Lincoln Center benefits, but obviously she's much more private.
She does do things, I mean, that are beneficial. She, you know, for $1 a year, just as the mayor works for the city, she works for the Board of Education, or did at least, raising funds and so on and so forth. I'm not saying that she's not doesn't add to, you know, to the universe as a whole, but on the other hand, as a political creature, she has absolutely no, I think, interest or talent in that field, whereas the pity of it all is that JFK Jr. was so talented in that arena.
But then wouldn't you say that, well, I mean, Carolyn is an excellent mother, but so wasn't Jackie. But in other words, she did not want her son to be in politics Is that true? Or
no, I think Jackie, what she didn't want was her son to go into acting. I mean, he was very interested in the stage and in film. I mean, when he went to Brown, even as a kid, when he went to Collegiate and when he went to St. David's, he was already acting in school plays. And Aristotle Onassis, his stepfather, used to come and watch him. And then when he went to Brown, he continued this. And he really did want to go into acting and would have probably been a great actor. I mean, he had that, you know, sensibility. But his mother was dead set against it. I mean,
because of?
I mean, she felt, I think, among other things, the kind of reverberations of Marilyn Monroe and Angie Dickinson and all of that. I mean, the women that her husband, JFK, had been with. And she was of that generation that looked down on thespians and the stage. And she also didn't want that kind of wide open publicity for her son. I think she was worried that, you know, he'd be out in the public domain and he would get, you know, killed just as Bobby and JFK had. So I think she didn't want that kind of exposure for him.
But with politics, she was more neutral, or?
Well, what happened was that instead of going directly into politics, JFK Jr., who I think considered himself too youthful at that point, went to law school. He went to NYU Law School, as had Caroline went to the Columbia University School of Law. And, I mean, this was at his mother's behest that he went to law school, and he went to work in Robert Morgenthau's Manhattan DA's office as an ADA, an assistant district attorney. And as one of the people that I interviewed, for example, who worked with him at the time as an ADA, named Al Khafif, who now is in private practice, said, "This guy took more lunch breaks and played more frisbee than anybody I've, you know, known since or before." I mean, that he obviously did not like the field of law, and this was not his career. So, and it's true. I mean, he worked as an ADA, which is working in Robert Morgenthau's office is a really posh job. I mean,
it's very political also.
Yeah, very political. He got the job, obviously, because his mother was good friends with Robert Morgenthau. And Bobby Kennedy Jr., by the way, also was an ADA in Morgenthau's office. But instead of going directly into politics, he went and started George Magazine, which was a kind of political satirist magazine, and started off as a very popular endeavor because JFK Jr. was involved. So, and I might add that Bill Clinton, when he became president, asked JFK Jr. to serve in his cabinet. He didn't specify what job. And as John told Rob Lytle, who was his best friend, he said, "You know, I'm not going to accept that position because all everyone will say is, well, I got the job, and I got the job offer only because I'm a Kennedy." So he was very sensitive to that whole thing.
He had trouble also passing the bar, I guess.
Well, that, of course, made headlines because, yeah, he flunked the bar twice.
Hunk flunks.
Right, hunk flunks. I mean, one of the reasons he cited was that he was involved at the time with Daryl Hannah, the Hollywood actress. This was before Jackie died in 94, so we're talking, you know, the late 80s, and he flunked. Of course, it made headlines because it was JFK Jr., but he gave a very, you know, he was the kind of guy who was just very offhanded and very kind of informal. And he said, "All right, so I'm no Clarence Darrow." Clarence Darrow having been the name of a very famous early 20th century lawyer. He said, "So what? Who cares?" And in any event, he passed it the third time around.
Right. And in terms of, I guess we should ask about your current book, which how long have you been working on that? It's called Bobby and Jackie, A Love Story.
Well,
interesting title.
You know, I've been working on it since I did the first Kennedy book that I did, which was published in 89, A Woman Named Jackie, because a lot of the information that I started gleaning then based on interviews with people was expanded upon as time went on. I did
David, you've done four Kennedy books?
This is the fourth, and my farewell to arms. I have come to, how should I put it, grow. It's like a divorce. I'm sure the Kennedys are as glad to be rid of me as I am of them. So
you're like a Kennedy dictionary in your head.
Absolutely. I've had it with them. They've had it with me. And
well, the interesting thing I think about A Woman Named Jackie was that it was an early example of, there hadn't been all that many biographies of Jackie Kennedy at that point. Is that true? Or
yeah, there were very few. And, you know, I actually came, it hatched in my brain as a potential idea because I was living in Israel at the time. I left the U.S. in 1983, and I lived in Israel 83 and 84. And the only library that I could use was the American Embassy Library because everything else was in Hebrew. They had books in English, so I'd go over there. And lo and behold, every book in the American Embassy's library was, of course, in English, but it was also about either an American president or an American tycoon, or they were all about, you know, Americana. And sort of, you know, I saw 20 books on JFK, and it sort of registered, well, what about his wife, Jackie? And so that's how the, you know, original A Woman Named Jackie came into play.
But then Kitty Kelly had done a book.
She had done a book previously called Jackie O, which, I mean, did well, but not formidably well. And besides that, I mean, there was a lot that she really, I mean, my A Woman Named Jackie was a definitive story of Jackie's life. I did, 5 years of research.
How many interviews?
Oh, my God, there must have been at least 1,000. And I was very lucky in getting interviews because I used as interviewers people that had worked actually in the Kennedy administration and who knew all the players. So.
Was it hard to get access to them?
Well, I mean, these people who had worked in the Kennedy administration who knew people were able to interview them for me. I mean, there were certain, obviously, people who, I mean, Senator Ted Kennedy wasn't about to talk on public record. And, you know, other insiders at the time. But as time,
would you say the Kennedys are, and the Bouviers are private in general or not?
The Bouviers talk like mad. I mean, they love to talk because, but they're not the Kennedys. They were a private family, well-to-do, etc. But they, most of whom, and particularly Edie and Edith Beale, whom everybody knows, you know, from Grey Gardens. And I actually went down to Miami Beach and interviewed little Edie Beale. I mean, that was a trip and a half.
What was she like?
Oh, my God. This woman was like a rock star who didn't perform public. But she did. She used to, even in Miami Beach, she used to go down to the local rock club and perform evenings. She was, what? I mean, what Jackie would have been had Jackie been off a rocker.
Yeah.
She had that same sort of Northeastern finishing girls' school accent. She went to the same, to Miss Porter's, the same private finishing school that Jackie attended. And she was just, you know, really too, the descriptions that she had for me of Jackie could have been applied to her. I said, so what do you think of Jackie? And she said, de trop, too much, in French, too much. Well, she was, you know, the epitome of too much.
What year was that when you met her?
This must have been 1987, 86. And then she began, after we met for, you know, maybe 3-4 hours. She was living in, Grey Gardens had been shut down. Her mother had died. And she had moved, of all things, to a small one-bedroom penthouse in Miami Beach and had one, as she proudly pointed out, had one cat as opposed to all the 40 or 50 raccoons and cats that lived with her and her mother at Grey Gardens. And I think I went out and I felt I should get her a little gift, so I brought her some coconut jam.
Did
she said, what do I need? Sorry. She said, what do I need this for? I can get this. I live down in Miami Beach. I don't need coconuts or jam. But, you know, that's what she got.
Well, did she flourish on her own without her mother?
I think she did better because she didn't have to answer to her mother. I mean, that relationship was one of these classic, you know, sort of mother-daughter relationships that they talk about in college classes and sociology, you know, courses about how two people can feed off of each other. And so she was doing very well. I was amazed. She seemed happy.
And were she and her mother close to Jackie? They had a kind of a problematic relationship or?
Well, her mother was the sister of Jackie's father, Black Jack Bouvier, and they lived in this estate in East Hampton, which was very near where Black Jack Bouvier had his home. And they simply couldn't, she was, how should I say, she was, you know, like avant-garde, way ahead of her time, and she was a bohemian. She was a singer, or at least she thought she was, and she simply didn't have any money, so they couldn't keep the place up. Mm-hmm. Which is what you see in Grey Gardens, which, you know, has been made into various renditions, plays, movies, etc.
Right.
And she, you know, they would eat cat food. And, I mean, Jackie, who ultimately did give them some money but initially didn't, tried to wash her hands of the whole things until the press got hold of it and pointed out, you know, that here was the first lady's aunt and cousin and they're, you know, on Starvation Row. And it was a public embarrassment for Jackie. So she ultimately did give them money. In fact, little Edie, who was living, in Miami Beach, said to me, you know, Jackie's sending me, I think it was $300 or $400 a month. And but she was pretty bitter against Jackie because Jackie hadn't helped them when they were living in East Hampton.
Yeah. Well,
and Jackie, by the way, was then married to Onassis, who was arguably the wealthiest man on earth, who, you know, in fact, she brought out there to Grey Gardens, hoping that he would, Jackie brought him out, hoping that he would help. And what he did was to give the Big Edie, the mother, a blue blanket with Christina, which was the name of his yacht, as well as his daughter, gave her a blanket, you know, with Christina embossed on it. I mean, that was his contribution to the fair.
Well, maybe there was no heat there.
Could be.
A woman named Jackie was a New York Times bestseller for a year or?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was like 30 weeks. It was number one. And this was in 1989. And it was translated into 35, 40 languages and book clubs. Oh, yeah. It became an NBC TV miniseries. And yeah, I mean, it was a full depiction of Jackie's life. I mean, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the beautiful. And but nevertheless, the people, you know, said that I was a critic, but I was a great admirer of hers. And many, I remember once on West 57th Street. I don't know if it's still there, but there's something called the Great Vegetable
Soup Company.
Soup Company, right? And I was sitting there one day. I think this was shortly after the book came out. She, of course, didn't know me from a hole in the wall because, I mean, how should she know me even though I was getting a lot of publicity? And I was eating vegetable soup, and suddenly I heard to the left of me, "How is that vegetable soup?" "I'm thinking of getting some sarsaparilla soda. What do you think?" And I turned around, and sure enough, there's Jackie Onassis sitting in her oval, round, dark glasses, wearing a purple Chanel suit. And she looks at me, and I look at her. I'm thinking, does she know who I am? Is this, you know, a joke? Is she putting me on? Or what? I figured out she had no idea who I was, and I said, "Yeah, I recommend, the soup, and by all means, this seems like a good place." And she went on to order her vegetarian specials and whatnot, and didn't say another word to me, and that was my main encounter with her. I mean, but I thought it was humorous since it took place in this vegetarian, you know, shop.
Yeah, well, what would you say about Jackie as a personality for people that haven't read your books?
Well, I think one thing that this particular book, Bobby and Jackie, I think shows is that she really had to stomach a lot. This marriage that she had to President Kennedy, in contrast to all of the positive publicity, since these were, you know, very a handsome young couple, more Hollywood than Washington, came into office with these two young kids, you know, also beautiful and, you know, pictured as really, you know, the young golden couple, and the marriage was anything but that. I mean, JFK, as we know by now, was an ardent womanizer who had women in and out of the White House on an almost daily basis in the White House swimming pool, who has been identified as having had long-term relationships with people like Marilyn Monroe and Angie Dickinson, and, you know, on and on. And we're not even talking about the daily visitors who came to the pool who were anonymous. I mean, who were starlets and models and airline stewardesses and secretaries. And Jackie knew about it, like any, you know, intelligent wife would. But she was first lady. What could she do? She couldn't walk out on her husband. I mean, there's a famous story where one of the White House maids gave her a pair of black lacy underpants and said, "This must be yours because I found it in your husband's bed." And she handed it to Jack. Jackie did a few hours later and said, "You better shop around and see who owns these because they're not mine." I mean, she was extraordinarily angry. And it was not the marriage that it was touted to be. And in retrospect, I think it put her in a terrible situation.
But on the other hand, I think she enjoyed being First Lady.
She did. It was a Faustian pact. I mean, she got, you know, the power, et cetera, the, you know, in exchange for what? For being married to the to this devilish figure who never, you know, she didn't have the matrimonial happiness that she would have wanted on the one hand, but in exchange she did get something else, yes. So it was more a marriage of convenience, I think, for both of them.
Well, but didn't she love him, though? I think there was some...
I don't think she loved him. I think she admired him. And as a matter of fact, as this book kind of points out, Bobby and Jackie, a love story, I think if she loved anyone, it was Bobby Kennedy. And they were much more suited to each other. I mean, he was much... I mean, JFK liked James Bond movies. He liked Broadway musicals. He, you know, was not an intellectual. He was a political animal. Bobby was much more attuned to the things that Jackie liked. I mean, she was an out-and-out intellectual, loved to read, who was well acquainted with French literature, having gone to the Sorbonne for a year. She went to Vassar. She was well-educated. And Bobby was much more interested in those sorts of subjects. So she was really more much... And there's another difference. I mean, Bobby wore his feelings on his sleeve. You always knew how he felt. He was very... pushy. He was more like the father, Joe Kennedy. JFK kept things, you know, he's the kind of guy who could screw you behind your back while he smiled at you. Bobby wasn't like that. And he was always, Bobby was always the way he was. I mean, even there was this great fight with Roy Cohn, the lawyer, when both of them were serving on the McCarthy Army hearings, HUAC, House of Un-American Activities Commission. I mean, when he hated somebody, you knew about it. When JFK hated somebody, you didn't know about it till he stuck it to you behind your back. Jackie, I think, admired Bobby, who was much more straightforward. She did not like politics, and she didn't like people who were politicians.
There she was, immersed in it.
She was immersed in it, but she wasn't happy in it. I think she was vastly unhappy. And then to make matters worse, JFK gave her this house called Wexford in the Virginia... in the rolling hills of Virginia so she could go horseback riding. And, you know, that was to get rid of her, get her out of the White House. She'd go horseback riding weekends.
And she loved horseback riding.
She was definitely a great equestrian and loved it from early childhood on. And
was she, like, exceptionally gifted in that area? Or?
Yeah, she rode at Madison Square Garden when she was a kid. So she was good. And, you know.
And what about Caroline?
Caroline also. John Jr., on the other hand, was allergic to horses, couldn't stand it. And as a matter of fact, he and Onassis, who would, you know, wear a suit, and John Jr., who was allergic to horses, would both go out to New Jersey when Jackie moved to New York and stand around in mud up to their knees while Jackie and Caroline would ride around on horses. And, you know, John said, I couldn't, you know, bear the thing, and neither could Ari. I mean, so the two of us were driven together, kind of, yeah.
Well, Bobby, though, back to Bobby, it seems that he had a, he loved his older brother.
Bobby was absolutely, you know, enamored of his older brother. And
wasn't his, he had two siblings that were killed in...
Yeah, he had Joe Jr., who was killed during World War II.
Was he the chosen...
Yeah, Joe Jr. was the chosen one to become, by Joe Kennedy Sr., the father, family patriarch, had selected Joe Jr. to become the president. I must say that what I know of Joe Kennedy...
Joe Jr.
Is nothing but bad. I mean, when he was at Harvard, for example, Harvard Law School, he founded a club which was pro-Nazi and, you know, anti-American, and he was a supporter of Hitler, as was the father, who was the American ambassador to the Court of St. James in England, and was virtually thrown out on his arse.
I find it hard to believe that the son would be so foolish to...
He did, but then he tried to erase all of that, I think at the father's behest, by joining the British armed forces before America entered the war, and he lost his life flying a mission over the English Channel. The plane he was in that he was piloting blew up. It carried the explosives. So I think he was trying to right his reputation. And then, of course, you know, then there was JFK, who was killed in October 63, and that put Bobby, I mean, in the forefront. And then, as we know now, I mean, he was killed in 68, so...
68,
right, June 68.
The period of your book, Bobby and Jackie, is between 1963 and 1968, or
it's
how does it range?
JFK's assassination, the end of 63, to Bobby's assassination in mid-68. That's when the affair with Jackie took place, and that's sort of, those are the bookends, the two unfortunate assassinations.
And then Martin Luther King was killed.
Martin Luther King was killed in 68.
There was a lot of political unrest at the time.
Yeah, political. It was an extraordinarily interesting period. You had Woodstock and you had, it was a socially it was a period of upheaval. I mean, almost revolution in this country, if you will. Students, of course, had taken over Columbia University and Stanford and, it was a wild time. I mean, there was, particularly because of the Vietnam War. So it was... I've often asked myself, I can't understand why students at that time were so rebellious and almost brought the nation to a standstill during the Vietnam War, whereas during this particular war, Iraq, there was nothing. People did nothing. Nobody's voice was heard. Students.
It's because of student loans.
Perhaps. That could be.
But the book itself is dealing primarily with the love story, supposed love between Bobby. Well, they had love, but I mean, how were you able to ascertain that there actually was more than just platonic affection?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I interviewed... People were willing to talk after Jackie's death. She died at a rather young age, 64, of cancer in 1994. 5 years before her son died in that airplane crash. And people, once she died, a lot of the people that I had interviewed for A Woman Named Jackie and for RFK, which was my second book, I went back to, and a lot of them were willing to finally go on record and talk about someone like Pierre Salinger, for example, who was very close to the family, someone like Clark Clifford, who was their personal attorney, and Arthur Schlesinger Jr., to say nothing of, you know, lesser-known people like Mary Harrington, who was a socialite and who had had an affair with Bobby and saw, for example, Bobby and Jackie necking on the back lawn of their estate in Palm Beach, the Kennedy estate. I mean, people were finally willing to go on record, and I think that it's incontrovertible. I mean, it's not to be, you know, negotiated. There was people.
Well, but David, isn't it possible that they were, you know, very physically affectionate without actually having an affair?
Well, let's put it like this. There's a photograph in the book which I think speaks volumes, and it's a photo of Jackie peering from behind the door with this lascivious, sexy smile on her face, eyes wide open. Bobby is looking at her as he and Ethel are walking away from that door. He's looking at her over his shoulder, and Ethel has this scowl on her face. I mean, if there's a photograph that can be taken and shown that's practically having the two of them in bed, then this is it. I don't think anybody can look at this photo and say that this was not a sexual, you know, relationship. Plus the fact there were so many instances that I was able to annotate in this book of sightings, etc. Plus the fact there are Secret Service records that I used, which Secret Service drivers would drive Bobby over to Jackie's home in the late evening. And he would because they had the times of their comings and goings, and he would tell the Secret Service agent, you don't have to wait for me, I'll be out in the morning. I mean, this, and then he'd come out in the morning, you know, with an expression of a Cheshire cat on his face, as the driver of the Secret Service car noted, because at that time Bobby became the senator from New York. I mean, there were so many of these kinds of sightings. Susan Pollock, in fact, you were even there. We interviewed Susan Pollock, a producer, TV producer, who said that she saw them going into a room at the Carlisle Hotel on Madison Avenue here in New York. It was late at night, and they came out early in the morning holding hands. I mean, they were seen at Le Club, which is a New York disco nightclub, no longer in, I don't think it's around anymore, but it was very fashionable in those days. It was a private club, and they were glued to each other dancing like two leaves in an autumn storm. I mean, people said that those in the inner sanctum who knew them knew about this relationship, absolutely. I can give you anecdote after anecdote, but they're in the book.
Well, isn't it possible that maybe people had a certain gut feeling that something was happening, but they would rather ignore it?
Because yes, it's possible, but the anecdotes that were related were such that it leaves no doubt because, someone in whose house they stayed would have certainly been aware of the fact that they spent the night in the same room, in the same bed, since there was only one bed in this particular room. And I'm talking here, for example, about Audrey Zorderer, who was a socialite who owned a house in Jamaica, Montego Bay, which is a very exclusive area. And she said when someone asked her, were they having an affair, she shook her head up and down. Catherine Livingston, who was an editor for Town and Country, said, visited Audrey about 2 weeks after JFK, after Bobby and Jackie left. Ethel was nowhere in sight. Bobby was spending more time with Jackie and her kids than he was with his own family. Pierre Salinger was around when this. It was common knowledge among insiders.
Wasn't Jackie devastated, obviously, by the assassination?
I think that's what initially brought her and Bobby together was a common and a shared grief. But on the other hand, I think Jackie was so angry about the position that she had been placed in by the Kennedy family of having to, bear this knowledge of her husband's constant womanizing, that there was a degree of anger and a seeking of revenge at the same time. But when you add that to the fact that there was a great attraction on her part for Bobby, I think the ingredients were obviously there for a romance.
Well, did she have other relationships after JFK died?
Yeah, she did. In fact, the first one that I was able to track was with none other than Marlon Brando, and it took place not too long after JFK had died. A number of months had passed, and Lee Radziwill, who was the sister of Jackie, was having dinner with George Englund, who was a great friend of Marlon's. They were at the Jockey Club in Washington, and she found out, Lee, that Marlon Brando was going to join them, and then she invited Jackie, who had always evidently had a crush on Marlon Brando. And it was a three-hour dinner, lots of drinking. When Jackie heard that Marlon was going to be there, she sent her kids. She was living in Georgetown at this point. She sent her kids to stay with her mother, who also lived in Georgetown, and the four of them went back to Jackie's house. And this, by the way, comes from Marlon Brando, who put this in the first draft of his autobiography. I think it's called Songs My Mother Taught Me. Mm-hmm. And it was published by Random House. And the editor who edited this particular volume, who was a friend of Jackie's, gave me the first draft of the book. And he described this evening in which, so Jackie and Marlon Brando are dancing at her home in Georgetown, and he's waiting and waiting and waiting, and, Jackie says nothing, and at a certain point, he says nothing, and then Jackie finally says, listen, do you want to spend the night? And he says, I thought you'd never ask. And they had a thing that night and then met up again several weeks later at an apartment he had borrowed in Manhattan, and that was it. But, so she had other relationships. And this is what's, I think, so interesting about the Bobby Jackie romance during that whole period. Both of them were seeing other people. Among others, Jackie was involved with Aristotle Onassis, her husband-to-be.
When did she actually start becoming friendly with him?
Oh, well, she became friendly in early 63 when she had lost her third child, died several days after being born prematurely, and she went off at Lee's invitation, since Lee was involved with Aristotle, Lee being Jackie's sister, and Aristotle Onassis invited. He said, why don't you ask your sister to join us on a cruise of the Mediterranean as a sort of voyage of recovery? And that's when she first spent about 10 days with him. JFK didn't want her to go because it was bad. It made him look, Aristotle Onassis was looked on as a kind of pirate, wealthy pirate, nouveau riche, et cetera, and he thought it made terrible press, which in fact it did, and didn't want her to go, but she went, and that's when she first met Onassis. They didn't have an affair at that time, but
wasn't she angry because JFK wasn't around when she had the when she gave birth? Was that that occasion?
That anger at on that occasion actually took place in... Here's another scenario which is amazing. I mean, in 1957, 1 year after JFK failed to win the vice presidential nod in the Democratic National Convention, and Stuart Symington was chosen instead, he went off with his brother Teddy and with Senator George Smathers of Florida, who was another womanizer, and who's dead now too, by the way, and whom I interviewed as well, and who corroborated a lot of the stuff about JFK. They went off into the Mediterranean on a boat, on a yacht that they had leased, with three women. Jackie, she had labor pains, she was pregnant, the baby was stillbirth. Where was John F. Kennedy? I mean, when she came to in the hospital, Jackie, after being taken there when she first felt labor pains, there was Bobby Kennedy sitting at the foot of her bed, and, you know, he was the one who was concerned. And it was, you know, Jackie who then said, you know, the person you could always count on in this family is Bobby. He's always there when you need him. And it was George Smathers who said to Jack on the boat, he said, you know, buddy, if you want to ever become president of the United States, you better haul ass back to your wife. Because once this thing gets out in the press that you're off with three broads in the Mediterranean, you ain't going to win nothing. So he hightailed it back home. But, you know, it was Bobby who was there for Jackie.
What about the relationship between Ethel Kennedy and her husband? Obviously, they had how many children?
They had 11, one of them born after Bobby's death, the 11th.
Well, obviously, they were close.
Well, let's put it like this. I mean, I think it was a similar, very similar marriage to Joe Kennedy Sr., the patriarch, and Rose Kennedy, his wife. Bobby was not the choir. This is another reason I wrote this book. Bobby has always been depicted as a kind of a choir boy, you know, the one in the family who didn't have affairs because he was the only one of the brothers who ever attended for a few years a Catholic school. I mean, and nothing could be further from the truth. He was as much a womanizer as his brother. The difference being, as his brothers, both Teddy and John, I mean, the difference, John Kennedy, the difference being that his affairs were longer lived, he was more loyal, more trusting, etc. I mean, maybe not as much a womanizer volume-wise, but his marriage to Ethel, again, I think was very much, I mean, the closest I can come to, you know, sort of characterizing it is a statement he made to Pierre Salinger, which is in the book. Pierre Salinger was the press secretary to the John F. Kennedy, and he said to me, you know, when I sort of confronted him about his relationship with Jackie, he said, you know, I love Ethel, that was his wife, but I love Jackie just as much, and I don't really know what to do. I think he loved Ethel, there's no question of it. They were, you know, very close. But again, it was a kind of marriage of, like Joe, the father with Rose, I mean, it was to make a family. I don't think it was a... you know, what would one say, the kind of hotbed marriage, you know, that he had with Jackie, the hotbed relationship. It was just more, you know, to make a family, and she came from an equally wealthy family, the Skakels of Connecticut, but I don't think it had, you know, it wasn't for Bobby that, not to say that he didn't love her, but he loved her as a wife, not as a lover. There's a difference.
And what about the relationship of Ethel and Jackie?
Those two ladies hated each other from the minute that Jackie was introduced into the family. Jackie married JFK in 1953. Ethel met her in 52, hated her. In fact, there's a funny anecdote where Jackie is saying to Ethel when she first meets her, she said, you know, when I was a kid, I always wanted to be a ballerina. And Ethel looked at her size 9.5 feet and said, with those feet, kiddo, you ought to think about soccer. I mean, there was animosity from the word go. I mean, Jackie was a champagne and foie de gras girl, and Ethel was a Coke and hot dog type. When they'd go on picnics, Jackie would bring the champagne and you know, the fine foods, and Ethel, you know, would look scornfully down at her and say, this is a family picnic, Jackie, for kids. And Jackie would say, well, I like champagne rather than, you know, whatever. And so they loathe each other, I mean, entirely, throughout. And
What about after the death of Bobby?
Well, there's one story that I find very touching, which is before the death. Well, it's after in a strict sense. Bobby had been shot in the head on I think there were four or five shots that clipped him in the head. This was after he'd won the California Democratic primary, and he's lying unconscious on the floor, you know, blood pouring. They take him to the hospital in Los Angeles. They move him from one hospital to another, and a day later, Jackie arrives from New York in a private plane. Teddy had come down from San Francisco to L.A., was so distraught that he could do nothing. And Ethel was completely, immobilized by this whole thing. And it was Jackie who finally ordered the doctors, and I see this really as a sign of love, who said to the doctors, I want you to, he was brain dead. And the doctors said to the family, you know, can we disconnect him from the respirator? And nobody said anything. And Jackie finally went aside with the doctor and said, look, you've got to disconnect him. He's dead. Nothing's going to bring him back. And she signed the forms. I don't even know if her signature was legal on those forms, since it was Ethel, who the closest of kin, who was supposed to. And they disconnected him because of Jackie. And after his death, I think the relationship between Ethel and Jackie was absolutely non-existent. I mean, as a matter of fact, Jack's sisters, including Ethel, who was the sister-in-law, had an edict that please don't mention Jackie's name in my presence.
But what about Jackie with her nephews and nieces? Was she?
Well, she made a very conscious effort to bring up, and I think this is one of the reasons that she married Onassis, besides the obvious financial attachment. I think her statement after Bobby was killed was, if they're killing Kennedys, then my kids are next. And She didn't want her kids at first to grow up in the U.S., and Onassis could afford, you know, to bring them up anywhere. He could afford private security, etc. And she really thought that Ethel, and she said it, was completely a completely dysfunctional mother. And she was. Look at the history of the Kennedy kids. I mean, two or three of them were killed. David Kennedy took his life, drug abuse, overdose. Michael Kennedy skied into a tree while playing touch football going down. I mean, they were completely... Bobby Kennedy Jr. was addicted to heroin. I mean, he finally straightened out, but he was found unconscious in a Denver airport with a needle jammed into his arm. I mean, this was a completely... I mean, and even as Bobby Kennedy... I think it was Jackie who said, you know, Ethel Kennedy is the worst mother who ever lived. And it's true. She was just completely out of it.
Well, I mean, there must have been some good qualities.
I'm not saying there weren't. I'm just saying what Jackie's reaction to Ethel was. I mean, I really can't think of much that Ethel, you know, did to inspire Americans after Bobby's death, except for the fact that she did have the celebrity tennis tournament in Forest Hills, at which she raised funds for mentally, people with mental problems. That's about it. I mean, other than that, she did absolutely nothing. Didn't involve herself in politics and retired from the public domain.
Public eye, yeah. Well, one question is, Jackie, of course, was always had enormous allure and attraction and appeal to the American public and to men, I guess you would say. But what do you think gave Jackie her special qualities? I mean, she seems very sophisticated, much more so than other first wives.
You know, she became first lady in the wake of three first ladies: Eleanor Roosevelt, Truman's wife, and Mamie Eisenhower. And I can, you know, hardly reckon in my mind, thinking of three sort of more unappealing, unsophisticated-looking, less attractive women. And here comes Jackie Onassis, who was really a handsome woman, beautiful. And not only that, but extremely well-schooled, well-spoken. And various men that I've spoken to who were friendly with her or, you know, were attracted to, and they were, you know, she entered a room, Jackie entered a room full of people, and everybody's head turned. I mean, she was one of these. She was our American queen.
But was it just because of her looks, or
no? I mean, a man that I interviewed said, "What?" I said, "Well, what was it that made her really so extraordinarily attractive. He said, you know, when she spoke to you on a personal basis, she made you feel that you were the only person in the universe. She had that sort of quality. And he doesn't even, it's really almost indescribable. She had what Diana Vreeland, who was the editor of both Vogue, and, I think Vogue and I think Harper's Bazaar, said she had a lure. A lure is something you can't buy, you can't learn it, you either have it or you don't. And as she said at the time, I think there are only two or three women in the world who have it, and Jackie is one of them. She just had that unspeakable quality that, you know, comes so rarely to just attract people.
Mm-hmm. So when she, and let's see, I'm trying to think. What made you decide to write this book?
Well, I mean, a lot of the research had been done, and so I knew it wouldn't take me the rest of my life to finish. I mean, I did have to interview some more people, but a lot of the interviews had been conducted for previous books. I did go back and interview other people, and I felt that there was this sort of historic depiction of John F. Kennedy and Jackie, which made them look like they were an extraordinarily happy couple, you know, well-suited, etc., and nothing, you know, absolute, it's an absolute lie.
Okay, this is Jerry Visco on Radio Free Brooklyn, Visco Disco, The Stupid Show, every Friday at midnight, and that was C. David Heyman, who is dead now, thank God, but I interviewed him before he died, which was, he died in 2012, and I did get some, there was some good information about some of the books that he wrote, and the gossip about the Kennedy family, and some other gossip, but I would say some of the stuff he says is true, and some of it is, he makes up some of it, but I would say that it is possible that RFK did have an affair with Jackie Kennedy. That might be true, but it's not definite. Anyway, this was an enjoyable interview, and I hope you had fun. And TGIF, have a great night, you. And just because it's The Stupid Show doesn't mean that we're stupid, but we have a sense of humor. So I want you all to laugh tonight and have fun and go out and party. Good night. Bye.
Do you want a man for president who's seasoned through and through, but not so doggone seasoned that he won't try something new? A man who's old enough to know
and young enough to do.
Well, it's up to you, it's up to you,
it's strictly up to you.
But it's Kennedy, 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 Kennedy for me.
Kennedy, 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 Kennedy.
Do you want a man with spirit who is not afraid to fight?
A man whose record shows that he will fight for what is right.
A loyal man who'll bring the job a fresh new point of view.
Well, it's up to you, it's up to you,
it's strictly up to you.
Because it's Kennedy, 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 Kennedy,
Kennedy, Kennedy, Kennedy, Kennedy.
And do you deny to any man the right he's guaranteed to be elected president, no matter what his creed?
It's promised in the Bill of Rights to which we must be true.
So it's up to you, it's up to you,
it's strictly up to you.
And it's Kennedy, 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 Kennedy for me.
Kennedy, 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 Kennedy.
Do you like a man who answers straight, a man who's always fair?
We'll measure him against the others, and when you compare, you'll cast your vote for Kennedy and the change that's overdue. So it's up to you, it's up to you, it's strictly up to you.